Chapter 52. Like a Thief in the Night. There are certain structures in the world, certain ideas, certain intellectual treasures that are truly mysterious. I'm beginning to suspect that the human race may have placed itself in grave jeopardy by failing to consider the implications of these mysteries. We have the ability, unique in the animal kingdom, to learn from the experiences of our predecessors. After Hiroshima and Nagasaki, for example, two generations have grown to adulthood in awareness of the horrific destruction that nuclear weapons unleash. Our children will be aware of this too, without experiencing it directly, and they will pass it on to their children. Theoretically, therefore, the knowledge of what atom bombs do has become part of the permanent historical legacy of mankind. Whether we choose to benefit from that legacy or not is up to us. Nevertheless, the knowledge is there, should we wish to use it, because it has been preserved and transmitted in written records, in film archives, in allegorical paintings, in war memorials, and so on. Not all testimony from the past is accorded the same stature as the records of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. On the contrary, like the canonical Bible, the body of knowledge that we call history is an edited cultural artifact from which much has been left out. In particular, references to human experiences prior to the invention of writing around 5,000 years ago have been omitted in their entirety, and myth has become a synonym for delusion. Suppose it is not delusion. Suppose that a tremendous cataclysm were to overtake the earth today, obliterating the achievements of our civilization and wiping out almost all of us. Suppose, to paraphrase Plato, that we were forced by this cataclysm to begin again like children, in complete ignorance of what happened in early times. Under such circumstances, 10 or 12,000 years from now, with all written records and film archives long since destroyed, what testimony might our descendants still preserve concerning the events at the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945 of the Christian era? It is easy to imagine how they might speak in mystical terms of explosions that gave off a terrible glare of light and immense heat, nor would we be too surprised to find that they might have formulated a mythical account something like this. The flames of the Brahmastra-charged missiles mingled with each other, and surrounded by fiery arrows, they covered the earth, heaven, and space between, and increased the conflagration like the fire and the sun at the end of the world. All beings who were scorched by the Brahmastras and saw the terrible fire of their missiles felt that it was the fire of Pralaya, the cataclysm that burns down the world. And what of the Enola Gay, which carried the Hiroshima bomb? How might our descendants remember that strange aircraft and the squadrons of others like it that swarmed through the skies of planet Earth during the 20th century of the Christian era? Isn't it possible, probable even, that they might preserve traditions of celestial cars and heavenly chariots and spacious flying machines and even of aerial cities? If they did, would they perhaps speak of such wonders in mythical terms, a little like these? O you, Uparikara Vasu, the spacious aerial flying machine will come to you, and you alone of all mortals seated on that vehicle will look like a deity. Visvakarma, the architect of the gods, built aerial vehicles for the gods. O you, descendant of the Kurus, that wicked fellow came on that all-traversing automatic flying vehicle known as the Saubapura and pierced me with weapons. He entered into the favorite divine place of Indra and saw thousands of flying vehicles intended for the gods lying at rest. The gods came in their respective flying vehicles to witness the battle between Kripakarya and Arjuna. Even Indra, the Lord of Heaven, came with a special type of flying vehicle which could accommodate 33 divine beings. All these quotes have been taken from the Bhagavata Purana and from the Mahabharata, two drops in the ocean of the ancient wisdom literature of the Indian subcontinent, and such images are replicated in many other archaic traditions. To give one example, as we heard in chapter 42, the pyramid texts are replete with anachronistic images of flight. The king is aflame, moving before the wind to the end of the sky and to the end of the earth. The king travels the air and traverses the earth. There is brought to him a way of ascent to the sky. Is it possible that the constant references in archaic literatures to something like aviation could be valid historical testimony concerning the achievements of a forgotten and remote technological age? We will never know unless we try to find out, and so far we haven't tried, because our rational, scientific culture regards myths and traditions as unhistorical. No doubt many are unhistorical, but at the end of the investigation that underlies this book, I'm certain that many others are not. Here is a scenario. Suppose that we had calculated, on the basis of sound evidence and beyond any shadow of a doubt, that our civilization was soon to be obliterated by a titanic geological cataclysm, a 30-degree displacement of the Earth's crust, for example, or a head-on collision with a 10-mile-wide nickel-iron asteroid travelling towards us at cosmic speed. Of course, there would at first be much panic and despair. Nevertheless, if there were sufficient advance warning, steps would be taken to ensure that there would be some survivors and that some of what was most valuable in our high scientific knowledge would be preserved for the benefit of future generations. Strangely enough, the Jewish historian Josephus, who wrote during the 1st century AD, attributes precisely this behavior to the clever and prosperous inhabitants of the antediluvian world who lived before the flood in a happy condition without any misfortunes falling upon them. They also were the inventors, Josephus wrote, of that peculiar sort of wisdom which is concerned with the heavenly bodies and their order. And that their inventions might not be lost upon Adam's prediction that the world was to be destroyed at one time by the force of fire and at another time by the violence and quantity of water, they made two pillars, one of brick, the other of stone. They inscribed their discoveries upon them both, that in case the pillar of brick should be destroyed by the flood, the pillar of stone might remain and exhibit these discoveries to mankind, and also inform them that there was another pillar of brick erected by them. Likewise, when the Oxford astronomer John Greaves visited Egypt in the 17th century, he collected ancient local traditions which attributed the construction of the three Giza pyramids to a mythical antediluvian king. The occasion of this, Greaves wrote, was because he saw in his sleep that the whole earth was turned over, with the inhabitants of it lying upon their faces and the stars falling down and striking one another with a terrible noise. And he awaked with great fear and assembled the chief priests of all the provinces of Egypt. He related the whole matter to them, and they took the altitude of the stars and made their prognostication, and they foretold of a deluge. The king said, "Will it come to our country?" They answered, "Yes, and will destroy it." And there remained a certain number of years to come, and he commanded in the mean space to build the pyramids. And he engraved in these pyramids all things that were told by wise men, and also all profound sciences, the science of astrology, and of arithmetic, and of geometry, and of physic. All this may be interpreted by him that knows their characters and language. Taken at face value, the message of both these myths seems crystal clear. Certain mysterious structures scattered around the world were built to preserve and transmit the knowledge of an advanced civilization of remote antiquity that was destroyed by a terrifying upheaval. Could this be so? And what are we to make of other strange traditions that have come to us from the dark vault of prehistory? What are we to make, for example, of the Popol Vuh, which speaks in veiled language about a great secret of the human past? A long-forgotten golden age, when everything was possible, a magical time of scientific progress and enlightenment, when the first men, who were endowed with intelligence, not only measured the round face of the earth, but examined the four points of the arch of the sky. As the listener will recall, the gods became jealous at the rapid progress made by these upstart humans, who had succeeded in seeing, succeeded in knowing, all that there is in the world. Divine retribution quickly followed. The heart of heaven blew mist into their eyes. In this way, all the wisdom and all the knowledge of the first men, together with their memory of their origin and their beginning, were destroyed. The secret of what happened was never entirely forgotten, because a record of those distant first times was preserved until the coming of the Spaniards in the sacred texts of the original Popol Vuh. The abuses of the conquest made it necessary for that primordial document to be concealed from all but the most highly initiated sages and replaced with a watered-down substitute written under the law of Christianity. No longer can be seen the Book of Popol Vuh, which the kings had in olden times. The original book, written long ago, existed, but now its site is hidden to the searcher and to the thinker. On the other side of the world, among the myths and traditions of the Indian subcontinent, there are further tantalizing suggestions of hidden secrets. In the Puranic version of the universal flood story, shortly before the deluge was unleashed, the fish god Vishnu warned his human protege that he should conceal the sacred scriptures in a safe place to preserve the knowledge of the antediluvian races from destruction. Likewise in Mesopotamia, the Noah figure, Utnapishtim, was instructed by the god Ea to take the beginning, the middle, and the end of whatever was consigned to writing and then to bury it in the city of the sun at Sippara. After the waters of the flood had gone, survivors were instructed to make their way to the site of the city of the sun to search for the writings, which would be found to contain knowledge of benefit to future generations of mankind. Strangely enough, it was the city of the sun in Egypt, Innu, known by the Greeks as Heliopolis, which was regarded throughout the dynastic period as the source and center of the high wisdom handed down to mortal men from the fabled first time of the gods. It was at Heliopolis that the pyramid texts were collated, and it was the Heliopolitan priesthood, or rather the Heliopolitan cult, that had custody of the monuments of the Giza necropolis. More than just Kilroy was here. Let us return to our scenario. 1. We know that our technological post-industrial civilization is about to be destroyed by an inescapable cosmic or geological cataclysm. 2. We know, because our science is pretty good, that the destruction is going to be near total. 3. Mobilizing massive technological resources, we put our best minds to work to ensure that at least a remnant of our species will survive the catastrophe, and that the core of our scientific, medical, astronomical, geographical, architectural, and mathematical knowledge will be preserved. 4. We are, of course, aware how slim are our chances of succeeding on both counts. Nevertheless, galvanized by the prospect of extinction, we make an almighty effort to build the arks or vars or strong enclosures in which the chosen survivors can be protected, and we focus our considerable ingenuity on ways to transmit the essence of the knowledge we have accumulated during the 5,000 years of our recorded history. We start by preparing for the worst. We assume that there will be survivors, but that they will be blasted back into the Stone Age by the cataclysm. Realizing that it may take 10 or 12,000 years for a civilization as advanced as our own to rise again, like a phoenix from the ashes, one of our top priorities is to find a way to communicate with that postulated future civilization. At the least, we would want to say to them, Kilroy was here, and to be sure they got the message, no matter what language they spoke or what ethical, religious, ideological, metaphysical, or philosophical leanings their society might exhibit. I'm sure we'd want to say more than just Kilroy was here. We'd want, for example, to tell them, those distant grandchildren of ours, when we had lived in relation to their time. How could we do that? How could we express, say, AD 2012 of the Christian era in a language universal enough to be worked out and understood 12,000 years hence by a civilization that would know nothing of the Christian or of any of the other eras by which we express chronology? One obvious solution would be to make use of the beautiful predictability of the Earth's axial precession, which has the effect of slowly and regularly altering the declination of the entire star field in relation to a viewer at a fixed point, and which equally slowly and regularly revolves the equinoctial point in relation to the 12 zodiacal constellations. From the predictability of this motion, it follows that if we can find a way to declare we lived when the vernal equinox was in the constellation of Pisces, we will provide a means of specifying our epoch to within a single 2,160-year period in every grand precessional cycle of 25,920 years. The only drawback to this scheme would become evident if a civilization equivalent to our own failed to arise within 12,000 or even 20,000 or 30,000 years. In that case, a monument or calendrical device declaring we lived when the vernal equinox was in the constellation of Pisces would no longer be unambiguous. If discovered by a high culture, flourishing at the very beginning of a future age of Sagittarius, for example, it could be read as meaning we lived 4,320 years before your time, that is, two full precessional months prior to the Sagittarian age, the 2,160-year months of Aquarius and Capricorn. But it could also mean we lived 30,240 years before your time, that is, those 2 months plus the full previous precessional cycle of 25,920 years. The Sagittarian archaeologists would not only have to use their wits to work out the meaning of the message, that is, we lived when the vernal equinox was in Pisces, but would need to decide from other clues which age of Pisces we had lived in the most recent, or the one in the previous precessional cycle, or perhaps even the cycle before that. Geology would naturally be of assistance in making such broad judgments. The civilizers. If we could find a way of saying we lived in the age of Pisces and could specify the altitude above the horizon of certain identifiable stars in our own epoch, say the prominent belt stars of the Orion constellation, we would be able to signal our dates to future generations with greater precision. Alternatively, we could do as the builders of the Giza pyramids appear to have done and lay out our monuments in a pattern on the ground, reflecting exactly the pattern of the stars in the sky in our time. There would be several other options and combinations of options open to us, depending on our circumstances, on the level of technology available to us, on the extent of the early warning we were given, and on which chronological facts we wanted to transmit. Suppose, for example, that there was not time to make proper preparations prior to the catastrophe. Suppose that the disaster, like the day of the Lord in 2 Peter 3, crept up on us unseen, as a thief in the night. What prospects might humanity be faced with? Whether as the result of an asteroid strike, or an earth crust displacement, or some other cosmic or geological cause, let us assume 1. Massive devastation all around the world. 2. The survival of only relatively small numbers of people, the majority of whom rapidly revert to barbarism. 3. The presence, among this remnant, of a minority of well-organized visionaries, including master builders, scientists, engineers, cartographers, mathematicians, medical doctors and the like, who dedicate themselves to salvaging what they can and finding ways to transmit the knowledge to the future for the benefit of those who might eventually understand it. Let us call these hypothetical visionaries the civilizers, as they banded together, at first to survive, later to teach and to share ideas. They might take on something of the manner and belief systems of a religious cult, developing a clear sense of mission and of shared identity. No doubt they would make use of powerful and easily recognizable symbols to strengthen and express this sense of common purpose, The men might wear distinctive beards, for example, or shave their heads, and certain archetypal imagery, like the cross and the serpent and the dog, might be used to link the members of the cult together as they set out on their civilizing missions to relight the lamps of knowledge around the world. I suspect, if the situation were bad enough after the cataclysm, that many of the civilizers would fail or meet with only limited success. But let us suppose that one small group had the skill and dedication sufficient to create a lasting and stable beachhead, perhaps in a region which had suffered relatively little damage in the disaster. Then let us suppose that some other unexpected disaster were to occur, an aftershock, or series of aftershocks from the original catastrophe, perhaps, and the beachhead was almost totally annihilated. What might happen next? What might be salvaged from this wreckage of a wisdom cult, which had itself been salvaged from a greater wreck? Transmitting the essence. If the circumstances were right, it seems possible that the essence of the cult might survive, carried forward by a nucleus of determined men and women. I suspect, too, with the proper motivation and indoctrination techniques, plus a means of recruiting new members from among the half-savage local inhabitants, that such a cult might perpetuate itself almost indefinitely. This could happen, however, only if its members, like the Jews awaiting the Messiah, were prepared to bide their time for thousands and thousands of years, until they felt confident that the moment had come to declare themselves. If they did that, and if their sacred objective were indeed to preserve and transmit knowledge to some evolved future civilization, it is easy to imagine how the cult members might be described in terms similar to those used for the Egyptian wisdom god Thoth, who was said to have succeeded in understanding the mysteries of the heavens and to have revealed them by inscribing them in sacred books, which he then hid here on earth, intending that they should be searched for by future generations, but found only by the fully worthy. What might the mysterious books of Thoth have been? Is it necessary to suppose that all the information they were purported to contain should have been transmitted in book form? Is it not worth wondering, for example, whether Professors de Santillana and von Deschend might have earned their place among the fully worthy when they decoded the advanced scientific language embedded in the great universal myths of precession? In so doing, is it not possible that they might have stumbled upon one of the metaphorical books of Thoth and read the ancient science inscribed upon its pages? Likewise, what about Poznanski's discoveries at Tiwanaku and Hapgood's maps? What about the new understanding that is dawning concerning the geological antiquity of the Sphinx at Giza? What about the questions raised by the gigantic blocks used in the construction of the Vali and mortuary temples? What about the secrets now being teased one by one from the astronomical alignments and dimensions and concealed chambers of the pyramids? If these two are readings from the metaphorical books of Thoth, it would seem that the numbers of the fully worthy are increasing, and that new and even more startling revelations may soon be at hand. To return briefly, and for the last time, to our evolving scenario. 1. At the beginning of the 21st century of the Christian era, near the cusp of the Age of Pisces and the Age of Aquarius, civilization, as we know it, is destroyed. 2. Among the devastated survivors, a few hundred or a few thousand individuals band together to preserve and transmit the fruits of their culture's scientific knowledge into a distant and uncertain future. 3. These civilizers split into small groups and spread across the globe. 4. By and large, they fail and perish. Nevertheless, in certain areas, some do succeed in making a lasting cultural impression. 5. After thousands of years, and perhaps several false starts, a branch of the original wisdom cult influences the emergence of a fully-fledged civilization. Of course, the parallel for this last category is once again to be found in Egypt. I would seriously propose, as a hypothesis for further testing, that a scientific wisdom cult, made up of the survivors of a great lost maritime civilization, could perhaps have established itself in the Nile Valley as early as the 14th millennium BC. The cult would have been based at Heliopolis, Giza, and Abydos, and perhaps at other centers as well, and would have initiated Egypt's early agricultural revolution. Later, however, beaten down by the huge floods and other disturbances of the earth which took place in the 11th millennium BC, the cult would have been obliged to cut its losses and withdraw until the turmoil of the Ice Age was over, never knowing whether its message would survive the subsequent dark epochs. Under such circumstances, the hypothesis suggests that a huge and ambitious building project would have been one way cult members could preserve and transmit scientific information into the future, independently of their physical survival. In other words, if the buildings were large enough, capable of enduring through immense spans of time, and encoded through and through with the cult's message, there would be hope that the message would be decoded at some future date, even if the cult had by then long since ceased to exist. The hypothesis proposes that this is what the enigmatic structures on the Giza Plateau are all about. 1. That the Great Sphinx is indeed, as we've argued in previous chapters, an equinoctial marker for the age of Leo, indicating a date in our own chronology between 10,970 BC and 8,810 BC. 2. That the three principal pyramids are indeed laid out in relation to the Nile Valley to mimic the precise dispositions of the three stars of Orion's belt in relation to the course of the Milky Way in 10,450 BC. This is a pretty effective means of specifying the epoch of the 11th millennium BC by using the phenomenon of precession, which has been rightly described as the only true clock of our planet. Confusingly, however, we also know that the Great Pyramid incorporates star shafts, locked in to Orion's belt and Sirius at around 2450 BC. The hypothesis resolves the anomaly of the missing years by supposing the star shafts to be merely the later work of the same long-lived cult that originally laid out the Giza ground plan in 10450 BC. Naturally, the hypothesis also suggests that it was this same cult, towards the end of those 8,000 missing years, that provided the initiating spark for the sudden and fully formed emergence of the literate historical civilization of dynastic Egypt. What remains to be guessed at are the motives of the pyramid builders, who were presumably the same people as the mysterious cartographers who mapped the globe at the end of the last ice age in the Northern Hemisphere. If so, we might also ask why these highly civilized and technically accomplished architects and navigators were obsessed with charting the gradual glaciation of the enigmatic southern continent of Antarctica from the 14th millennia BC, when Hapgood calculates that the source map referred to by Philip Buache was drawn up, down to the end of the 5th millennium BC. Could they have been making a permanent cartographical record of the slow obliteration of their homeland? And could their overwhelming desire to transmit a message to the future through a variety of different media, myths, maps, buildings, calendar systems, mathematical harmonies, have been connected to the cataclysms and earth changes that caused this loss? An urgent mission. The possession of a conscious, articulated history is one of the faculties that distinguishes human beings from animals. Unlike rats, say, or sheep, or cows, or pheasants, we have a past which is separate from ourselves. We therefore have the opportunity, as I've said, to learn from the experiences of our predecessors. Is it because we are perverse, or misguided, or simply stupid, that we refuse to recognize those experiences unless they've come down to us in the form of bona fide historical records? And is it arrogance or ignorance which leads us to draw an arbitrary line separating history from prehistory at about 5,000 years before the present, defining the records of history as valid testimony and the records of prehistory as primitive delusions. At this stage in a continuing investigation, my instinct is that we may have put ourselves in danger by closing our ears for so long to the disturbing ancestral voices which reach us in the form of myths. This is more an intuitive than a rational feeling, but it is by no means unreasonable. My research has filled me with respect for the logical thinking, high science, deep psychological insights, and vast cosmographical knowledge of the ancient geniuses who composed those myths, and who, I'm now fully persuaded, descended from the same lost civilization that produced the map makers, pyramid builders, navigators, astronomers, and earth measurers, whose fingerprints we've been following across the continents and oceans of the earth. Since I have learned to respect those long forgotten and still only hazily identified Newtons and Shakespeares and Einsteins of the last ice age, I think it would be foolish to disregard what they seem to be saying. And what they seem to be saying to us is this: that cyclical, recurrent, and near-total destructions of mankind are part and parcel of life on this planet, that such destructions have occurred many times before, and that they will certainly occur again. What, after all, is the remarkable calendrical system of the Mayas if it is not a medium for transmitting exactly this message? What, if not vehicles for the same sort of bad news, are the traditions of the four previous suns, or sometimes of the three previous worlds, passed down in the Americas since time immemorial? By the same token, what might be the function of the great myths of precession, which speak not just of previous cataclysms, but of cataclysms to come, and which, through the metaphor of the cosmic mill, link these earthly disasters to disturbances in the heavens? Last, but by no means least, what burning motive impelled the pyramid builders to erect with such care the powerful and mysterious edifices on the Giza Plateau? Yes, they were saying Kilroy was here. And yes, they found an ingenious way to tell us when they were here. Of these things I have no doubt. I'm also impressed by the enormous lengths they went to provide us with convincing proof that theirs was a serious and scientifically advanced civilization. And I'm even more impressed by the sense of urgency of a vitally important mission that seems to have enlightened all their works and deeds. I go on intuition again, not on evidence. It's my guess that their underlying objective could have been to transmit a warning to the future, and that this warning could be to do with a global cataclysm, perhaps even a recurrence of the same cataclysm that so clearly devastated mankind at the end of the last ice age, when Noah saw that the earth had tilted and that its destruction was near, and cried out in a bitter voice, "Tell me what is being done on the earth, that the earth is so afflicted and shaken." These words are from the Hebrew Book of Enoch, but similar afflictions and shakings have been foretold in all the Central American traditions that speak of the demise of the present epoch of the world. An epoch, as the listener will recall, in which the elders say that there will be a movement of the earth, and from this we shall all perish. The listener will also not have forgotten the date calculated by the ancient Maya calendar for the end of the current world age. The day will be 4 Ahau, 3 Kankin, and it will be ruled by the sun god, the ninth lord of the night. The moon will be 8 days old, and it will be the third lunation in a series of 6. In the Mayan schemes of things, we are already living in the last days of the earth. In the Christian scheme of things, too, the last days are understood to be upon us. According to the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of Pennsylvania, this world will perish just as surely as did the world before the flood. Many things were foretold to occur during the last days, and all of these are being fulfilled. This means that the end of the world is near. Similarly, the Christian psychic Edgar Cayce prophesied in 1934 that around the year 2000, There will be a shifting of the poles. There will be upheavals in the Arctic and the Antarctic that will make for the eruption of volcanoes in the torrid areas. The upper portion of Europe will be changed in the twinkling of an eye. The earth will be broken up in the western portion of America. The greater portion of Japan must go into the sea. Curiously, the epoch of the year 2000, which figures in these Christian prophecies, also coincides with the last time, or highest point, in the great upward cycle of the belt stars of the Orion constellation, just as the epoch of the 11th millennium BC coincided with the first time, or lowest point of that cycle. Could the recondite influences of gravity, when combined with our planet's precessional wobble, the torsional effects of its axial rotation, and the rapidly growing mass and weight of the Antarctic ice cap, be enough to spark off a full-scale crustal displacement? We may never know, one way or another, unless it happens. Meanwhile, I don't think the Egyptian scribe Manetho was being less than literal when he spoke of a harsh and deadly cosmic power at work in the universe. Just as iron is likely to be attracted and led after the lodestone, Manetho wrote, but often turns away and is repelled in the opposite direction, so the salutary, good, and rational movement of the world at one time attracts, conciliates, and mollifies that harsh power. Then again, when the latter has recovered itself, it overthrows the other and reduces it to helplessness. In short, through metaphors and allegories, I suspect the ancients may have tried to find many ways to tell us exactly when and why the hammer of global destruction is going to strike again. I therefore think, after 12,500 years of the pendulum, that it would only be wise for us to devote more of our resources to studying the signs and messages that have come down to us from that dark and terrifying period of amnesia which our species calls prehistory. A speeding up of physical research at the Giza Plateau would also be highly desirable, not only by Egyptologists determined to resist any threats to the scholarly status quo, but by eclectic teams of investigators who could bring some of the newer science to bear on the challenges of this most enigmatic and impenetrable of sites. The chlorine-36 rock exposure dating technique mentioned in Chapter 6, for example, looks like a particularly promising means of resolving the impasse over the antiquity of the pyramids and the Sphinx. Likewise, if the will is there, then a way can be found to get through to whatever lies beyond the little door concealed in the Great Pyramid 200 feet up the southern shaft of the Queen's Chamber. At the same time, serious efforts should be made to investigate the contents of the large, square-edged, and apparently man-made cavity in the bedrock, deep beneath the paws of the Sphinx, that was discovered when a seismic survey was carried out at the site in 1993. Last but not least, far away from Giza, I suspect that our efforts might also be repaid if we were to undertake a proper investigation of the subglacial landscapes of Antarctica, much the most likely continent to hide the complete remains of a lost civilization. If we could establish what destroyed that civilization, then we might be in a better position to save ourselves from a similar cataclysmic fate. In making these latter suggestions, I am, of course, fully aware that there are many who will be scornful and who will assert the uniformitarian view that all things will continue as they have done since the beginning of creation. But I'm also aware that such scoffers in the last days are those who, for one reason or another, are deaf to the testimony of our forgotten ancestors. As we've seen, this testimony appears to be trying to tell us that a hideous calamity has indeed descended upon mankind from time to time, that on each occasion it has afflicted us suddenly, without warning and without mercy, like a thief in the night, and that it will certainly recur at some point in the future, obliging us, unless we are well prepared, to begin again like orphaned children in complete ignorance of our true heritage. Walking in the Last Days. Hopi Indian Reservation, May 1994. Across the high plains of Arizona, for days and days and days, a desolate wind had been blowing. As we drove across those plains, towards the tiny village of Shungapovi, I went over in my mind all I had seen and done in the previous 5 years. My travels, my research, the false starts and dead ends I'd encountered, the lucky breaks, the moments when everything had come together, the moments when everything seemed about to fall apart. I'd travelled a long road to get here, I realised, far longer than the 300-mile freeway that had whisked us up into these austere badlands from Phoenix, the state capital. Nor did I expect to return with any great degree of enlightenment. Nevertheless, I'd made this journey because the science of prophecy is still believed to be alive among the Hopi, Pueblo Indians, distantly related to the Aztecs of Mexico, whose numbers have been reduced by attrition and misery to barely 10,000. Like the ancient Maya, whose descendants all across the Yucatan are convinced that the end of the world is coming in the year 2000 y pico and a little, the Hopi believe that we are walking in the last days with a geological sword of Damocles hanging over us. According to their myths, as we heard in chapter 24, the first world was destroyed as a punishment for human misdemeanors by an all-consuming fire that came from above and below. The second world ended when the terrestrial globe toppled from its axis and everything was covered with ice. The third world ended in a universal flood. The present world is the fourth. Its fate will depend on whether or not its inhabitants behave in accordance with the Creator's plans. I had come to Arizona to see whether the Hopi thought we were behaving in accordance with the Creator's plans. The end of the world. The desolate wind blowing across the high plains shook and rattled the sides of the trailer home we sat in. Beside me was Santha, who'd been everywhere with me, sharing the risks and the adventures, sharing the highs and the lows. Sitting across from us was our friend Ed Ponist, a medical surgical nurse from Lansing, Michigan. A few years previously, Ed had worked on the reservation for a while, and it was thanks to his contacts that we were now here. On my right was Paul Sifke, a 96-year-old Hopi elder of the Spider Clan, and a leading spokesman of the traditions of his people. Beside him was his granddaughter, Melza Sifke, a handsome, middle-aged woman who had offered to translate. "I have heard," I said, "that the Hopi believe the end of the world is coming. Is this true?" Paul Sifke was a small, wizened man, nut brown in color, dressed in jeans and a cambric shirt. Throughout our conversation, he never once looked at me, but gazed intently ahead, as though he were searching for a familiar face in a distant crowd. Melza put my question to him, and a moment later translated her grandfather's reply. He says, "Why do you want to know?" I explained that there were many reasons. The most important was that I felt a sense of urgency. My research has convinced me that there was an advanced civilization, long, long ago, that was destroyed in a terrible cataclysm. I fear that our own civilization may be destroyed by a similar cataclysm. There followed a long exchange in Hopi, then this translation. He said that when he was a child in the 1900s, there was a star that exploded, a star that had been up there in the sky for a long while, and he went to his grandfather and asked him to explain the meaning of this sign. His grandfather replied, "This is the way our own world will end, engulfed in flames. If people do not change their ways, then the spirit that takes care of this world will become so frustrated with us that he will punish the world with flames, and it will end just like that star ended." That was what his grandfather said to him, that the earth would explode, just like that exploding star. "So the feeling is," I said, "that this world will end in fire. And having viewed the world for the past 90 years, does he believe that the behavior of mankind has improved or worsened?" He says it has not improved. We're getting worse. "So in his opinion, then, the end is coming." He said that the signs are already there to be seen. He said that nowadays nothing but the wind blows, and that all we do is have a weapon pointed at one another. That shows how far apart we've drifted and how we feel towards each other now. There are no values anymore, none at all, and people live any way they want without morals or laws. These are the signs that the time has come. Melza paused in her translation, then added on her own account, "This terrible wind, it dries things out, it brings no moisture. The way we see it, this kind of climate is a consequence of how we're living today, not just us, but your people as well." I noticed that her eyes had filled with tears while she was talking. "I have a cornfield," she continued, "that's really dry, and I look up into the sky and try to pray for rain, but there is no rain, no clouds even. When we're like this, we don't even know who we are." There was a long moment of silence, and the wind rocked the trailer, blowing hard and steady across the mesa as evening fell around us. I said quietly, "Please ask your grandfather if he thinks that anything can now be done for the Hopi and for the rest of mankind." "The only thing he knows," Melza replied when she'd heard his answer, "is that so long as the Hopi do not abandon their traditions, they may be able to help themselves and to help others. They have to hold on to what they believed in the past. They have to preserve their memories. These are the most important things. But my grandfather wants to tell you also, and for you to understand, that this earth is the work of an intelligent being, a spirit, a creative and intelligent spirit that has designed everything to be the way it is. My grandfather says that nothing is here just by chance, that nothing happens by accident, whether good or bad, and that there is a reason for everything that takes place." At the millstone, grinding. When human beings from around the globe and from many different cultures share a powerful and overwhelming intuition that a cataclysm is approaching, we are within our rights to ignore them. And when the voices of our distant ancestors, descending to us through myths and sacred architecture, speak to us of the physical obliteration of a great civilization in remote antiquity, and tell us that our own civilization is in jeopardy, we are entitled, if we wish, to stop up our ears. So it was, the Bible says, in the antediluvian world. For in those days, before the flood, people were eating, drinking, taking wives, taking husbands, right up to the moment that Noah went into the ark, and they suspected nothing till the flood came and swept all away. In the same manner, it has been prophesied that the next global destruction will fall upon us suddenly, at an hour we do not suspect, like lightning striking in the east and flashing far into the west. The sun will be darkened. The moon will lose its brightness. The stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then, of two men in the fields, one is taken, one left, and of two women at the millstone grinding, one is taken, one left. What has happened before can happen again. What has been done before can be done again. And perhaps there is indeed nothing new under the sun. Fingerprints of the Gods was written and narrated by Graham Hancock.